"Gentlemen, I advise you to take cover until we can bring the ship into action," he told Denham and Ferris quietly, and felt a little prick of pride that neither of them moved. It was the tradition of Drake and Nelson not to flinch from the coming storm of fire, and Clinton himself went on standing at his ease, hands clasped at the small of his back, calling a small adjustment to the helm, as Black Joke drove in eagerly, the terrier going for the hold on the bull's nose. He saw the American move his head, a final judgment of range, considered against the clipper's rolling, and beside him Ferris murmured the age-old blasphemy which Clinton this time could not find it in him to resent, for it was also a part of the great tradition. "For what we are about to receive," said Ferris. And as if he had heard the words, the American drew the sword from the scabbard on his belt and raised it above his head. Involuntarily, all three naval officers drew breath together and held it. Huron was at the bottom of her roll, her cannon pointing down into the sea close alongside. Then she was coming up, the barrels rising, levelled, and the sword arm fell. The six cannon leapt together in perfect concert, and the startling white gusts of smoke shot 50 feet from her sides, completely silent, for the sound had not reached them. And for a fleeting part of a second, they could believe that Huron had not loosed her broadside. Then the very air beat in upon them, shocking the eardrums, seeming for a moment to suck their eyeballs from their sockets, with the vast disruption of air caused by passing shot, and close above Clinton's head, a stay parted with a whiplash crack. That was one ball high, but under Clinton's feet the deck jumped with the multiple impact of a ball into her, and the howl rang like the strokes of a gigantic brass gong. A single ball came through at deck level. It struck a burst of sparks from the steel hull, like Brock's fireworks at Crystal Palace, brilliant orange, even in the strong sunlight, and the hole it tore through Black Joke's plating was fringed with bare, jagged tongues of metal, like the petals of a silver sunflower. A seaman, in striped vest and baggy canvas breeches, who was kneeling behind the bulwark, took the ball full in his chest. His severed limbs were strewn untidily across the gunboat's spotless deck, and the ball went on to strike the foot of Black Joke's mast, shivering it like a tall tree struck by lightning, and tearing a long white splinter from the seasoned Norwegian pine. Then, with its force mainly spent, the ball rolled the length of the deck, smoking and stinking of scorched metal, until it thumped into the scuppers and rolled idly back and forth. Only then, seconds after the broadside struck, did the crash of the discharge reach their ears across the turbulent waters that separated the two vessels. "Not bad shooting for a Yankee," Ferris grudged them, raising his voice above the gun thunder. And Denham had his watch out and was timing how long it took for the clipper's gun crews to reload. 45 seconds, Denham intoned, "and not a single gun run out again. A bunch of fairground tinkers could do better." Clinton found himself wondering if it was merely bravado, or complete indifference to the danger and violent death which allowed the two younger officers to chat so casually, while the seaman's severed arms still twitched on the deck, not 20 feet away. Clinton was afraid. Afraid of death, and afraid of failing in his duty, and afraid of being seen to be afraid. But then he was older than they, for despite their manly airs, Ferris was a boy and Denham barely 20. So perhaps it was not courage, but ignorance and lack of imagination. 55 seconds, Denham grunted scornfully, as the next ragged broadside crashed into Black Joke's iron hull, and somebody started to scream below decks, a high, mindless keening like steam from a kettle. "Send somebody to stop that fellow," Ferris murmured to the seaman who crouched nearby, and doubled over till the man hurried away. Seconds later, the screaming stopped abruptly. "Good work," Ferris told the seaman, as he took his place at the bulwark again. "Dead, sir, he is, poor devil." Ferris nodded without change of expression, and moved closer to listen to his captain. "Mr. Denham, I am going to lead the boarding party. You are to be ready to sheer off and leave us to it. Should there be any danger to the ship? There was a sharp fluting sound, like the flight of a giant insect past their heads, and Clinton glanced up irritably. The marksmen in Huron's rigging had opened fire. The pop of their muskets seemed muted and without menace. Studiedly, Clinton ignored them and went on issuing his final orders, raising his voice to compete with the crash and roar of shot, and the strike of it into the gunboat's hull. As Clinton finished speaking, Denham blurted abruptly, "It's hell not being able to reply." He was staring across at the clipper, whose silhouette was blurred with a bank of pale gun smoke that even the gale could not disperse rapidly enough. "It's bad for the men," he corrected himself swiftly. And Clinton had his answer. Denham was as afraid as he was, and the knowledge gave him no comfort at all. If only they could do something, anything, instead of having to stand here in the open and make studied conversation, while Black Joke tore across the last few hundred yards of white-crested sea that still separated them. The crash of cannon shot tearing into Black Joke's vitals was almost continuous now, as the fastest gunners aboard Huron outstripped the others. The bow cannon that the American captain was supervising and laying was firing three times to the others twice. Clinton had been counting the plumes of muzzle smoke. This would be the sixth ball they sent into the little gunboat since the American had given the order to fire as many minutes ago. He watched the gun smoke bloom again from the cannon's maw, and this time the gunboat's deck was swept as if by hailstones, but leaden hailstones as big as ripe grapes that pierced the thin steel bulwarks with pricks of sunlight and clawed chunks of wood from the main deck, a deck that was now threaded with meandering scarlet snakes of blood and slick little puddles of it that spread from beneath the inert and crumpled figures that seemed to be scattered in purposeless profusion wherever Clinton looked. Black Joke was taking merciless punishment, perhaps already more than she could afford. But they were close now, very close, seconds only left to go. He could hear the cheering of the clipper's gun crews, the terrified wailing of the slaves who were huddled down in pathetic little heaps upon Huron's decks. He could clearly hear the rumble of the 16-pounders run out against the straining tackles, and hear the shouted commands of the gun captains. The girl at the rail still stood rigidly erect, staring white-faced across at him. And she had seen and recognized him now. She tried to raise a hand to wave a greeting, but the iron slave cuff on her wrist hampered the movement. As Clinton stepped forward, the better to see her, something tugged sharply at the sleeve of his jacket, and behind him Ferris gasped. Clinton looked down at his arm. The sleeve was torn, and the white lining showed in the tear. It was only then he realized that it was a musket ball fired from Huron's crosstrees, which might have struck him squarely had he not moved, and he turned quickly to Ferris. The boy was pressing a wadded handkerchief to his chest, standing very upright. "You are wounded, Mr. Ferris," said Clinton. "You may go below."
"Thank you, sir," wheezed Ferris, "but I'd just as soon not miss the kill."
As he spoke, a droplet of blood formed in the corner of his mouth, and with a chilling little jolt, Clinton realized that the boy was probably mortally struck. Blood in the mouth would almost certainly mean a lung hit. "Carry on then, Mr. Ferris," he said formally, and turned away. He must not let the doubts assail him now. He must not question whether his decision to board Huron had been correct, or if his execution of the attack had been properly carried out, or if he was responsible for those dismembered corpses that littered Black Joke's deck, or for the dying lad who still determinedly kept erect. He must not let his resolve weaken. Instead, he slitted his eyes against the lowering sun that outlined Huron's bare masts with golden halos, and stared across at her with true hatred. It was then he realized suddenly that at last her bow cannons could no longer bear. The terrible battering of close-range grapeshot was abating as they sailed into Huron's stern quadrant. "Bring her up 2 points," he snapped, and the Black Joke cut in sharply under Huron's stern. She loomed suddenly high above them. And there was no more cannon fire from her, while the clipper's tall hull shielded them from the gale. The sudden silence was ghostly, unnerving, as though the cannon fire had damaged his ears, and he was rendered deaf. Clinton shook off the sense of dreamlike unreality and strode down the length of his deck. "Up the jokers!" he shouted, and his crew rose from where they had been crouching under the fragile bulwark. "You've shown you can take it, boys. Now let's show those damned Yankees we can hand it out too." "The Tiger for Tongs!" yelled a voice, and suddenly they were all cheering, crowding the gunboat's side, so he had to cup his hands to his mouth to give the order. "Helm a lee! Let fly all!" And Black Joke spun up sharply under Huron's counter, spilling her wind, while the seamen in her rigging stripped the canvas off her. The two ships came together with a rending, crackling crash, the gnashing of steel plate against timber and the shattering of glass in Huron's sternlights. A dozen of Black Joke's sailors hurled the three-pronged grappling hooks high over the clipper's gunwale, with the lines snaking up after them, and then heaved them up tight and made them fast to the portside cleats. And a swarm of seamen, cheering wildly, went up Huron's stern like a troop of vervet monkeys pursued into the trees by a hunting leopard. "Take command, Mr. Denham," Clinton shouted above the hubbub. "Aye, aye, sir." Denham's lips moved, and he saluted as Clinton thrust his cutlass back into his scabbard and headed the next rush of his men, those who had been freed by the heaving to of her sails. The two hulls were working against each other as viciously as millstones, grinding and bumping, the gap opening and closing as the wind and the seas tore at them. At Huron's rail, a dozen of her crew were hacking at the grappling lines with axes, the clunking of the blades into her timber blended with the popping of pistols and muskets as their mates blazed down on the swarm of seamen climbing up from the gunboat's deck. One of Black Joke's sailors climbed swiftly, hand over hand, pushing off with his feet from the clipper's raked stern like a mountaineer, and he had almost reached the rail when an American sailor appeared above him, an axe held high, and then sent thudding down into the woodwork, severing the line at a single blow. The sailor dropped like a wind-blown fruit from the bow into the gap between the hulls. He floundered for an instant in the surging water, and then the two ships came together again, with the shriek of rending timbers chewing the man like a pair of monstrous jaws. "More lines!" Clinton howled, and another grappling hook flew over his head, thrown by a stout British arm, and the line whipped around Clinton's shoulders. He seized it, heaved once upon it to set the hook, and then swung across the gap, and his boots thudded on Huron's stern. He had seen his seamen drop on the severed line, so he climbed with the strength and agility of terror and desperation, and only as he swung one leg over Huron's rail did the battle rage seize him. The world changed colour before him, seen through a reddish haze of hatred and fury. Hatred for the slave stink that rose to offend his soul, and fury for the death and punishment that his ship and his seamen had suffered. His cutlass sprang from its scabbard with metallic rasp, and there was a man rushing down upon him. And the man, naked to the waist with a bulging hairy belly and thick, heavily muscled arms. He was brandishing a double-bladed axe above his head, and Clinton uncoiled his lanky frame, as though it were the S in an adder's body, straightening as it strikes. He drove the point of the cutlass through the axeman's furry, silvered beard, and the axe flew from his raised hands and went sliding away across the deck. Clinton stood over the man he had killed, placed his foot on his chest, and yanked the cutlass blade out of his throat. A bright scarlet, carotid fountain followed the blade out, splattering Clinton's boot. Half a dozen of his seamen had reached Huron's deck ahead of Clinton, and without a word of command spoken, they bunched to guard the grappling lines over the stern, holding off Huron's axemen with cutlass and point-blank pistol fire. Behind them, Black Joke's men came swarming aboard, unopposed, surging forward, their cheers rising into a triumphant chorus. "At 'em, the jokers! All together, boys!" howled Clinton. The madness had taken complete hold of him now. There was no fear, no doubts, not even conscious thought. The madness was infectious, and his men howled with him. Hunting as a pack, like the wolf or the wild dog, they swept across Huron's deck to meet the wave of her own seamen rushing back from Huron's bows.